Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Downstairs History. We had some great pods out recently. Kevin Fong talking about Apollo 13 is a classic. You ought to go and listen to that. Also, interesting pods over the weekend. Oh, about the House of Byron. That was a good one. Please go and check that out as well. This podcast is a look at 17th century shipbuilding. I know how much you guys love that. Richard Enzer is the 17th century shipbuilding oracle. And I wanted to ask him about what happened in this funny little island of Britain. Why did the ships that were being produced here start to evolve? How did it change? Why was Britain able to extend its reach, its maritime reach across the oceans and eventually onto every continent? And the story starts in the 17th century. So enjoy this podcast. If you want to watch naval history, then the place to do it is historyhit.tv, my digital history channel. You can go, you can listen to all the back episodes of the podcast. You can go on there. You can listen, watch hundreds of hours of documentary. If you use the code POD1, P-O-D-1, you get a month for free, and then you get the second month for just £1, euro or dollar. So please go and check that out. In the meantime, enjoy Richard Enzer. Richard, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
It's a pleasure, Dan. It's good to talk to you again.
Well, it is good because you are my mad aunt in the attic, because I am a big fan of Georgian maritime history, Georgian sea power. And I like to say that the modern world was built from 1690 to 1815 by wooden ships, the Royal Navy. And every time I let that little voice tell me that there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in the 17th century, and actually the real action is probably there, and it's worrying. So I'm going to open the attic. This metaphor doesn't work. I'm opening the attic and I'm addressing you now face to face. Tell me about the revolution that goes on in the period that you're writing about.
I just love the 17th century Navy. I write books about them because they're so little known.
Why is this period so important?
It's where the Royal Navy really began to dominate the world. Up to the 17th century, we were just another naval power. But as you know, following the great 30 shipbuilding programme of 1677, we began to dominate the world seas right up until the end of the days of sail. So it's the ships, the way they developed and were built in the 17th century, that really take my interest, why they became so good and so powerful.
What happened in England? What I find fascinating, what happened in England in the 17th century that transformed England and then when it became Britain in the early 18th into a globally hegemonic sea power, given that the 17th century was a totally chaotic time in England and indeed in the Isles? We have a couple of civil wars. We have a king. We have an experiment in republicanism. We have a catastrophic war of the kingdoms. We have another king deposed, another illegitimate son of a king rising up and fighting a rebellion against his uncle. Like, it's a crazy century, and yet something's going on in the dockyards. How is that all happening?
Well, I believe a lot of it is down to the king himself. As we all know, he was famous for his pleasures.
We're talking Charles II here.
Yeah, indeed. Famous for his pleasures, and his number one pleasure, funnily enough, was the Royal Navy. Spent more time at Admiralty board meetings than any other member of the Admiralty. He spent an awful lot of time there. He knew personally all the master shipwrights. He knew most of the people in the yards themselves, and he certainly selected all his officers. So he took an enormous interest in the Navy, promoted it, and I think a lot of it comes from him. Plus the fact, of course, he established things like the Royal Society. It promoted technology, was always happy to engage and talk to people about it. And it's promotion of shipbuilding and shipwrights, as well as officers, that made us, I believe, a great naval power.
Apart from taking an interest, what is he actually doing? Is the money coming in? Is it expertise? It's not all just about battlefield bravery. Navies are something that take years or generations to embed.
After the Third Dutch War, the Navy was in pretty poor state. And he, of course, had Samuel Pepys, Secretary to the Admiralty, also a Member of Parliament, persuaded Parliament to vote for £600,000 to build this vast fleet of 30 new ships. And they were all incredibly well designed. The design of the 23rd rate would remain pretty unaltered for about the next 40 years. And added to that were 9 second rates, 3 deckers, and on top of that, the great first rate Britannia. And it was this series of ships that really began to dominate the world stage. They fought a defensive battle at Beachy Head in 1692, of course. They defeated the French at Barfleur-la-Hoe, which up until Trafalgar was regarded as the greatest naval victory ever. This £600,000 was a special tax that was put on and which paid for those ships. Great difficulty collecting the money. This is before the Bank of England, as you well know. But nevertheless, this money was all found and paid for this great fleet of ships.
And what about the technical spec? Are these ships different to what's being built elsewhere in the world? Has Britain got a secret technological edge at the moment?
I don't think so, no. French ships were equally good. It's just, I think we had a conservative, because we live, I suppose, in northern climes, we had a rather conservative approach to the strength of our ships. And they did survive very well storms, and they survived a long time. They could be repaired, didn't fall apart under the stress of the sea. So they were pretty well designed and pretty well respected amongst their crews and their opponents.
I mean, what about the dockyards that were able to build these ships? Are they're some of the most important places in English history now that sadly no longer have the kind of maritime tradition?
Well, that's right. Just looking back at that time, I've just written a book called Master Shipwright's Secrets, which goes right into the heart of what these shipwrights had to do to design their ships. It's often been thought that Pepys says that some of these shipwrights design their ships by eye alone, and nobody really believed that. And there's one or two treatises written. And while I was researching for a previous book, I was in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, as you know the place well, and going through Pepys's Rawlinson collection. And there I found an interesting little treatise by the master shipwright of Deptford Dockyard. And it's the dimensions of a ship. And it's a little treatise written specifically for Samuel Pepys. It's addressed to him. And the first few pages are just lists of dimensions of a ship, the length of the gun deck, the height between the decks and the size of the gun ports, all the usual stuff. But then at the very back of this treatise was lists of column of figures, and it's digital information describing the outside lines of a ship. Pure digital, so they didn't rely on even just a draft. It's no good just scaling from that draft. You needed this digital information to build this ship to. And I thought, my goodness me, how advanced is that? Because that's the very technique we use to build aircraft today, digital information. So I used that as a template to write a book about just exactly what the master shipwrights did to create these ships.
So they weren't just, I've always thought that there was an element of just looking at it by eye. And so you think they were measuring everything out and looking at performance and then making adjustments and building the next one better.
Yeah, absolutely they did. Very, very technical. Now, you imagine you've got a draft of a ship in front of you, 1/48 scale, which has been drawn by a master shipwright. Now, people think that's what they built exactly the ship to. Now, you get out your scale rule and measure off, see how wide the ship's got to be on that piece of curve where that frame is. And, well, you're going to be inches out, aren't you, by the time you measure that and put it in the ship. So They didn't rely on this. They relied on actual digital information calculated by a formula for... They used a formula to create a curve, a geometric formula to create a curve. Could be a true arc, maybe, but they used geometric calculations to for the position of a frame on every piece of the curve. So they knew exactly where this frame should be when they built it and exactly the shape when they marked it out to cut the frames. So, yeah, incredibly technical. And it astounded me just how technical this was. This guy, John Shish, who wrote this treatise, he doesn't explain the formulas he used to actually create the curves. Anthony Dean, who also wrote a treatise for Pepys, he did. He had the formula, and he just used simple curves just to make the explanation simple. But Shish, he gave actual results of the calculations and the formula without actually saying what the formula were. Now, being incredibly lucky working in the aircraft industry, I was able to work back from his results to actually find the formulas he used. Did this by simply writing the loop, putting a test formula inside a loop, doing the calculations in an instant, and comparing the calculations created by the computer with Shish's figures, I was able to come up with exactly the formulas Shish used. Wow, that was a eureka moment when I could discover this. And that's the basis of this new book I've just written.
Join us this month on Gone Medieval from History Hit. I'm Matt Lewis.
And I'm Eleanor Yonaga. This April, dive into our special mini-series.
With the help of leading experts, we're tracing the foundations of England by exploring the country's most powerful Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
We'll be looking at Northumbria, Mercia, and Wessex, as well as the rulers and their councils who helped shape a nation.
Make sure to get every episode by listening and following Gone Medieval from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
So you've discovered the secret formula. Who were these shipwrights? Were they regarded as much as you might regard, you know, the radar and specialist or the code and cipher specialists in the Second World War? Were they highly prized?
Well, I don't think they really were. There's a famous incident where the members of the Royal Society, with their expertise, and all the people who were in there, they were the famous mathematicians, and which we all know about, and they decided they would design the shape of the hull because they knew better. They knew about fluids and all things like that. They came up with a design of a ship. But it didn't sail very well. And the master shipwrights had the great pleasure of having to widen it and use their expertise to put the thing right. And Samuel Pepys said, these shipwrights, it's more of an art form than a science form. But you needed an awful lot of understanding to know just how wide a sailing ship should be to carry her weight of sails. The involvement of that, of course, is very scientific.
It's worth remembering that in this period, there's still... terrible mistakes getting made. I mean, the Vasa in Sweden in the 17th century just sails away from the quay and capsizes immediately. So a lot was at stake.
Yes, it was. Well, I think the Vasa, she's got the same size guns on her gun deck as on the upper deck, 24-pounders. So she was rather top heavy. And English ships were not built like that. On the lower deck, the ship guns nearest the water, they would have vast heavy cannon. Ships like the London, for instance, or nearly all major warships, had guns weighing 2.5 tons, the same size guns as those on the Victory. And on the upper deck, the next deck above, they were much lighter. They were only between a ton and a ton and a half, and so on. We were very careful in placing guns like that. Now, the other thing about the ships of the 17th century, this fleet of 20 third rates that Pepys and Charles had built, they had 32-pounder guns on the gun deck, which is the same size as Nelson's Victory, and very, very powerful guns. But these ships were very small. It's the same size ship as the ship in Hartlepool, the Trincomalee. That is a six-rate, carries tiny guns, but it was the same size overall dimensions as these ships built during the 17th century. So the 17th century ships, they were solely designed to carry huge weights of armament. And that's why sometimes they had to be girdled, made wider to carry their guns, because it never occurred to them that if the ships were not too stable because of all the guns they carried, they never thought to take any of the guns off. They just made the ship a little bit bigger one way or another.
What other secrets? Because you mentioned other secrets that you've uncovered. Come on, tell me about the secrets of these ships.
Apart from working out the formula that Shish and other master shipwrights used to design their ships, which, to be honest, can be a bit boring for most people, so I've kept a chapter on that very short. The other thing is mould making. Now, you imagine when you've got the ship's plans and you want to actually carve them out on the timbers, you need the moulds, and a very technical thing to be doing. And I can't find anywhere where there's clear explanations of how these moulds were made. All the contemporary old books, they don't use drawings. And when you read a description of how a mould was made and all the technical words that go into it, it's absolutely, it's numbing to try and read and understand it. But I spent considerable amount of time reading, spending countless hours trying to read and understand this stuff. But eventually, with help of contemporary works, works from 1717 and slightly later works, eventually come up with the idea of just how these moulds are made. Now, I love drawing and stuff, and rather than try and describe them as previous authors have done, I've got a drawing of each stage of making these moulds, and it's so much clearer when you've got a drawing showing this stuff rather than just a written explanation.
Were these English ships effective in battle?
Yeah, it's a number of things. To start with, we need a powerful battle fleet, of course, to see off first of all, the Dutch and then the French. There's also tremendous developments made because we had a problem with ships in the Mediterranean. A lot of our trade was being taken by Barbary corsairs. And Charles II received the base at Tangier as part of his dowry when he got married. And he used this as a base to put Royal Navy ships to protect our trade ships from the Barbary pirates. Quite amusing, really, because first of all, he thought, oh, we'd do what all other nations do in the Mediterranean, and we'll purchase a proper galley with hundreds of galley slaves to row, because, of course, sometimes there's no wind. That was a disaster because the Royal Navy wasn't used to having slaves, didn't know how to use them. The ship never went to sea, and Tangier was faced with the prospect of a few hundred mixed Moors, even Red Indian slaves and some captured Greeks, people like that who were supposed to be galley slaves, but they never actually pulled an oar. Caused lots of problems by burning wood and things like that. The Muslim Moors wouldn't eat the Royal Navy provisions of pork, insist on eating beef. So that was a disaster. The ship went rotten and never went to sea. Charles II then came up with the idea of galley frigates. This was very slim, lightly armed ships, no guns on the main deck, instead it had oars, and only guns on the upper deck. He produced two of those ships, the Charles Galley and the James Galley. They proved very successful, but when they took a large ship, I think it was an Algerian ship, they couldn't harm the men below decks. The crew of the ship fled below decks and couldn't be harmed. They had to take this ship by boarding, a lot of casualties. So that was a bit of a disaster. So then Charles came up with the idea of building the Tiger, which was a ship with oar ports between the gun ports. And it's a very amusing story on how King Charles developed and built this ship, the Tiger, because she was one of the casualties of the Third Dutch War. And when she came back to be repaired, she was in such an appalling state, they couldn't really repair her. So eventually she fell apart. But Charles insisted on keeping the ship on the books. So this gave him an opportunity to keep a crew of warrant officers and their servants, which he used as a benevolent fund for people he thought worthy, you know, injured old seamen, people like that. And also their servants or apprentices would be their carers. It went on like that for a few years. But with the Popish plot, Charles fell out with the Admiralty and did things entirely himself. He more or less run the Navy for himself. And he had out of the budget for repairs to rebuild a new ship called the Tiger. This was a whole new ship, which the Admiralty thought was just a repaired ship. And it was a great surprise to them when a totally new ship turned up. So Charles II used all sorts of devious means to circumvent all his own rules to build the ship that he wanted.
Richard, that was a tour de force. Thank you very much for allowing me to question you about the 17th century shipbuilding. You're not just a writer, but you're actually trying to get one day a 17th century ship reconstructed, which would be the best thing ever.
Weren't it just? Yeah. There's a huge development going on at the old historic Deptford Dockyard site. And the locals down there, the locals themselves, want to build a replica ship. They're having a lot of problems because the developer isn't doing anything at all. And of course, before they start doing anything, it means the people at Deptford can't start building their replica ship either. You know, I just give them all the support I can, and when they do start to build their ship, it will be great fun. It will be being just a quarter of a mile, a short walk away from the Cutty Sark, seeing an actual ship built in exactly the 17th century style, will be a great tourist attraction. It should be very successful.
It'd be the best thing ever, Richard. Good luck. How can people find out about, well, tell them about your book, and then also how they find out about that project?
I've just finished this this book, just been published, The Master Shipwright's Secrets. It contains lots of information concerning how they built ships in the 17th century, things that haven't been discussed before. And it also relates to, and it certainly is a great help to the people of Deptford who want to build a replica warship of the 17th century to commemorate the great Deptford Dockyard that was originally founded by Henry VIII.
And if people want to find out more about the Deptford Dockyard project, where do they go?
Yeah, if they go online and type in Build the Lennox, they will find this, L-E-N-O-X.
Build the Lennox, everybody. Words to live by. Thank you very much for joining us, Richard.
Okay, Dan. Lovely talking to you.
Hi, everyone. It's me, Dan Snow. Just a quick request. It's so annoying, and I hate it when other podcasts do this, but now I'm doing it, and I hate myself. Please, please go onto iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, and give us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps, basically boosts up the chart, which is good, and then more people listen, which is nice. So if you could do that, I'd be very grateful. I understand if you don't want to subscribe to my TV channel. I understand if you don't want to buy my calendar, but this is free. Come on, do me a favour. Thanks. Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us, and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.